Thank you. I'm Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I appreciate being here very much. I appreciate especially being here at the 20th anniversary of this event. I appreciate especially that it, in some measure, not only honors Alcoholics Anonymous, not only honors the ways that God loves us. He loves us through each other. He loves us through this program. He loves us through the environment in this beautiful place. But in another way, it honors a good friend of mine. It honors Jim. He had 45 days of sobriety, more than I did, and he was really a pain in the neck about it, if you want to know. We'd say, yes, Jim, we know that Benoit says you're the head of the family. And we know she means that. But in the Marine Corps, where I was, head means something entirely different than head. And I want to thank Joe. I want to thank Susan and David. And I want to tell you what a great job you're doing as the chair of this conference. Thank you. Thank you. Thank all of you. Everybody that had anything to do with putting this on. Everybody that had anything to do with the fact that I am here, I'm grateful for that. I thank you, Sheila, for calling me and inviting me. I thank Joe for picking us up at the airport, always a colorful experience. But I know Joe, and I recognize Joe, and there's a little bit of a struggle, and usually there's some phone calls back and forth and all of that. Some years ago, I was on my way to Cincinnati, I believe. I called my office during the week for messages. The receptionist said she hadn't been there very long. She said, well, you live an interesting life. I said, yeah, what do you mean? She said, well, I see from this note here you're going to be in Cincinnati this weekend. I said, I am. What does the note say? She says, well, the guy that's going to pick you up at the airport says he has a wooden leg, and he's going to be carrying a big book. And he had a wooden leg and a big book under his arm, and a guy had been a Hell's Angel. He was all decked out with earrings and stuff like that. I liked him right away. We people that ordinarily wouldn't mix, I liked this guy. I'll tell you why. I should tell you before I move any further, which is something you already know, I'm a member of the Pacific Group, and my sobriety date, because of God's grace and because of sponsorship, and because of the enthusiasm that is here. I haven't had a drink since August 14, 1966. And that is as astonishing to me tonight as it is to you. In fact, I commented that if you're new here, nothing much changes over the years. I was the guy standing up the longest in the sobriety countdown. It gave me a little sense of uneasiness. Where are the old timers? Where the hell are they? I want somebody out there ahead of me, you know. But it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. And in that weekend in Cincinnati some years ago now, I got to know this guy. There's a peace in me that responds to the rogues, because there's a piece in me that's never going to get it. There is a little piece in me that belongs only to God. There is a piece in me that belongs to you. There is a piece in me that belongs to my wife. And there's a piece in there that is never going to get it. Just always want to be heading out toward the edge of the deal. Always want to be thinking I can do it myself when I have no power. There's a piece in me that is a bit of a rogue. And somebody told me one day, said, you have got to develop some compassion for that little piece in you that's never going to get it. You keep trying to shove it down and squeeze it out of existence. And welcome it. It's going to be there. Welcome it. Let the light shine on that piece. It needs loving more than any piece of you. You've got to develop some compassion for it. And I have discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous that the surest way for me to have some compassion for that little piece in me, that little rogue in me, is to come into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, spot the rogue in the room, and let him know, I love you. I love you. I care what happens to you. And if I can do that, I'm at peace with a whole lot of stuff. And so I love it here. I love it here. I will tell you that I was so touched at Van Ooy's talk today. So loved her talk. I was brought up in a hellfire and brimstone home. And there's a lot of people here that had that. All that, you're going to go to hell when you die. My mom used to say, what will you do when you meet your maker? Apologize. I guess. And I was affected by Sheila's talk, and for the same reasons for these talks. There is some of these, you see, that I'm no longer in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana. But I guess it's still there, isn't it? Yeah. But the church is in me. There is something in me that I need a connection. I need a connection. I'm just like Wilson when he stood at Winchester Cathedral and said, much moved, I wandered outside. And he comes back to it several pages later in his story. He says the meaning of my moment in the cathedral at about page 12 or something like that. He says the meaning of that moment that he had never in all his drinking forgotten. 17, 18 years must have gone by. He's in Towns Hospital. He's a few days sober. He says the meaning of the cathedral experience was clear to me at last. And he says something like, I had needed and wanted God, and He was humbly and was humbly willing to have Him with me, and He came. And He came. I've had that feeling sitting in a meeting, and I know you have too. Just a drop. But it brings you back. We don't forget it. And then he goes on to say, and soon the sense of His presence was lost to me, blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself. I got that about Wilson. I got that. There is that book, I'm in there. I'm in that book. I'm in Bill's story. And so, the talk last night and the talk this morning brought back an old biblical line to me. It says, greater love hath no man than this, than to lay down his life for his friend. And I always thought that was about dying for somebody else, this crucifixion story. But it's about living for somebody else. It's about, here's my life, laying it down there. And Sheila loved us with that. Laid her life down there. And Van Ooy laid her life down. In sweet and wonderful ways. And I was touched. And you do that for each other. In the way you share. In the way the sponsorship ethic is here. I was there the day in Texas that Bob White said, somebody go ahead. I want you to meet my sister, Ed.
Right.
All right. One of the best talks given are those that are never taped. So if that one doesn't play, it's going to be good. And when you get your little packages from Ed with the tapes in them, it'll be just like my high school annual. It said in the photograph, Clint Hodges, not shown. We're driving along the freeway. We're supposed to get off at an off-ramp and pick up Byron. When we pulled up at the off-ramp, we didn't, but we saw this little figure with his back to the roadway, and we stopped. Clancy was driving. He's honking. He's, you know, doing his driving is largely honking. And I freely confess my love for that man. This figure turned around. It was Byron, who had made much money in his lifetime. He turned around, and he had a sign to celebrate whatever we were doing that day. It said on his chest, "We'll work for food." And I... We laughed for 10 miles to get him in the car. And we had fun that night, and Jim brightened and came with us. And I didn't see him alive again after that. So there's much joy, and there's sorrow, and there's pain, and there's memories. But with it all, there's a wonderful overriding sweetness. A bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. A bail bondsman that didn't have any idea what he was doing. And I know that because I have called him every year on my birthday to thank him for bringing me here. And it just doesn't register. I mean, he's, "Oh, hi, nice to hear from you again. You saved my life, I think. How's everything going?" First year I called him, he said, "Yeah, Clint, where are you?" He thought we were going to do some more business together. And you know the wonderful thing about just having 1 year in Alcoholics Anonymous, in August of 1967, after 1 year here in AA, when he asked me where I was, I knew where I was and I could tell him. How many times have we stood in a phone booth afraid that they'll trace the call, not willing to tell anybody where we are, hanging up if there's a delay, and calling back wherever we're calling? And after a year with you, a miracle had happened in my life. And I am very, very aware of that tonight and very grateful for it. Absolutely grateful for it. There is something about the energy and the beauty of this program that is such an inspiration to me. And it is such an inspiration to the men and women in Los Angeles that I love and respect. And I want to thank John so much for coming with me. I don't think when he asked me if I could go with me when I spoke next that he'd have to buy a ticket to Oklahoma, but he did. And it's been a terrific thing to have him with me. And I appreciate that so much. That bail bondsman took me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 29 at the time, and it wasn't the first time I'd been to meetings. I was at a meeting 5 years earlier in Portland, Oregon. And nothing that you had going on in Portland, Oregon in 1961 was of any interest to me. It should have been, and it was not. And I was to do some 5 years of tough drinking after that. And this bail bondsman brought me to what he did was he put me in his car. I'm walking down the street. I lived in his shed at the time. A shed with three other guys. I thought it was a double garage. Can you believe that? It was a shed is what it was. I referred to it as a double garage for years. Some years ago now, Linda and I, my wife and I, went over and blended it. She said, "I want to see the garage." And we drove down and she said, "Is that it?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I got news for you. That's not a garage. That's a shed is what that is." And I looked and by God, no car had ever gotten into that thing. Smelly little nasty 8x10 room
with a sticky linoleum floor and a wet mattress on a steel cot, and a radio that played when you didn't want it to play and wouldn't play when you wanted some music. One I'd take out and stick in the dirt by the door, thinking it'll quit now, it's unplugged. It played. I had a fit of enthusiasm one day. I'd bought a copy of Playboy magazine, and that had been in there for a while. Largely comprised my social life by then. I had nothing. I'm sleeping in the park sometimes. I'm sleeping in a little nasty shed. I'm sleeping in jail. I'm doing whatever I'm doing. And this bail bondsman pulled over to the curb one day and honked his horn, and I walked over. He said, "I'm taking you someplace today." And I didn't even ask. I did not ask. And he brought me to you. He brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, the Glendale Alano Club. And I was around there. I liked it. I liked you. I liked what I felt and heard in there. And 2 weeks, three maybe, went by, and I ran into some cash and some amphetamines on the same day. And I was still in the Marine Reserves, just starting that. I had been off active duty for some months and supposed to be going with the reserve unit. And we were going to Fort Sill that year. And my last drunk started in Lawton, about 100 miles or however far away it is from here. In those really colorful bars in Lawton, Oklahoma, outside Fort Sill. Those scary places to be. Is that right? Is it Lawton that's right outside Sill? Yeah. I got drunk and stayed drunk. I was supposed to be a commander of troops. I was a first lieutenant. Marched troops through the Dallas airport on the way back there. We bumped a whole flight of civilians, and they weren't happy anywhere, and I'm putting them through close-order drill. The colonel and I had a big talk when I got back. And I had on active duty some talks with people, like commanders. One of them told me, "There's no room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic lieutenant. No room here. Not for you." And I got off active duty and went into civilian life and kept that little thread with the Marine Corps going on with the reserves, because I wanted more than anything to be a good Marine officer. It broke my heart to be drinking hot vodka in the orange groves north of El Toro instead of showing up. I had good jobs in the Marine Corps. Air observer, flying around the back of airplanes, instructor at the NCO leadership school. I loved it, except I can't pack the gear because I'm a drunk. And I got out of there with a whisper away from a general discharge under conditions other than honorable. I got that honorable discharge. I moved to Glendale. I lived in an apartment for a while. And I lived in my car for a little longer, and then they disappear. The car, I don't know where it is. I don't think I'll find it now. And then in the shed and in the park, and this guy brought me there, and I'm sober in AA for 3 weeks, and I'm drunk for two. And I came back after we got back to Los Angeles to that little club. I walked over there that day, and it was the 14th of August, and it was 1966, and it was a blistering hot day, and I needed to be there. And at mid-morning on that day, a Monday, the guy in the club was doing his job in AA, and I know that because the door was open and the coffee was on. And he welcomed me. "How are you doing?" "Not good." "What happened?" "I got drunk." I don't know why, but I said, "I got drunk and let everybody down."
He brightened. He said, "Oh, are you alcoholic? Are you alcoholic?" And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. But I know I need to be there that day. I know that I can't be on the streets. I'm subject to arrest. I owe too many people too many things. I know I don't have a home to go to. I can't go to the shed. I can't go to the park. I needed to be there that day. I knew that, and I was careful with my response. And I finally said, "Yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now." And it really meant I'm a mild case, you know. I won't cause any trouble. But he was lovely with it. He said, "So, you're alcoholic and you got drunk." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, alcoholics do that." He said, in fact, something that I've not heard anybody say. He said, "If you're an alcoholic like I am an alcoholic, you will drink no matter what." He said, "Good people in AA will tell you don't drink no matter what. You will drink no matter what." That's so interesting because I knew it was true. I had tried to quit, didn't you? We didn't want to be alcoholics. I had tried. God, I went 6 weeks the first time I quit. And then a day the next time. An hour. This is the last half pint I'm going to need. And I'd be at the liquor store again 5 times that day. I don't quit. And he knew it. And he really unraveled it for me. He really gave me the simple dignity of the fact of the matter. And the fact of the matter is, I ain't quitting. I can't. And I knew that and I didn't know it. I knew that and I could not have said it. And when he said, "You will drink no matter what," I got it. I got it. I knew. I couldn't have said it in your language. I could not have told myself or anyone that I had placed myself beyond human aid. And I most certainly had. I had no idea that Wilson didn't talk about quitting. I didn't know. He simply said there at the hospital, "I was separated from alcohol for the last time." But he said that. I didn't know you would not ask me to quit drinking. You would instead know that there had to be a miracle for me to stay. I thought, I didn't know that the steps would be articulated in a way that would surprise you, because we think if you're new, you think it's about quitting. But if you could quit, you wouldn't be here. We heard the steps read tonight. You'd think it would say it. It's like, these people, if you're new, they are not shy, as you know, about telling you what to do. Nor is the book. And you would think it would say, "Step one, quit." Come on now. It doesn't say that. It says, step one, you got to get that you are toast. Powerless, unmanageable, that's the deal. Chuck C., who was referred to it this weekend, said, "If I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had 2. And so I say, I quit drinking on August 14, 1966, and that's not quite it. That's not quite it. And the fact that I did not have a drink from that day till this isn't because I had any power to quit. It's because of God's grace. I can assure you, in the 35 years I've been with you, I have been crazy enough to drink.
I have been angry enough to drink. I have been successful enough to drink. I have failed enough. I have been insolent enough to drink. Guilty enough. And I didn't drink. And that's because not just that I stayed here with you, although that is so important. Not just that I changed my conduct when I got here, as we must change it. But because of God's grace. Wilson says language that, in this book, it'll annoy you. You might as well get used to that. The book is annoying. For example, Wilson says, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And I'm thinking, how nice for you, Bill. We're all so happy. But look at it. I mean, on the 13th of August and the 14th of August, I was a drunk. On the 15th, I didn't drink. And that is moving right along. I mean, there was that day. I mean, his impact on me was sudden. Sudden. This power is so elegant that it will move you. And all you have to do is say yes to it and let go of whatever we're hanging on to so we can't be moved. Sometimes the energy required of Alcoholics Anonymous in unity and in service in those legs is the energy of committing to getting your butt in a seat at a meeting or committing to pick up a new guy or the coffee or the chairs. Sometimes the energy of recovery of the steps is letting go. And when we can't let go, we can't be moved. I was fascinated by the fact that in the maybe 30s or 40s or 50s, there was a great cry for live monkeys in research labs and zoos around the world, and the place to get them was Africa. And you can't get them. Those teams that go in there to try to grab live monkeys are hard to get. You set the trap for them, they don't fall for it. Or they will release themselves or each other. Or they'll get caught and a predator will come along and kill them. And then one time they got the message, they got the idea of what you have to do. These teams that go in, these hunters that go in, and they would scatter heavy metal jars, weigh 100 pounds with a long narrow neck, on the jungle floor. And they would drop in those jars the nuts and the sweets that the monkeys loved. And the monkeys would come upon them and watch them for a while and make sure there's nothing goofy going on. And the hunters had all gone back to camp to play cards. And gradually the monkeys would stick their hands down the necks of those long heavy jars and grab that treat. But they couldn't get their hand back out because they'd made a fist and they wouldn't let go of the treat. And 2 days later, the hunters had come back in and they had all the monkeys they needed. They'd trank them and then put them in cages and ship them off. The monkeys were not happy. They were squealing and they were furious that they were had. I can't tell you how many times I've gone down to see my sponsor with my hand in a jar I could barely lift. Hard. And we laugh and joke and talk about my problem. And I get an answer. And I say, thank you so much. And I walk out of his office. I can't execute the answer I've been told to do. I can't let go of the problem. And so if you're new, you will love your problem. We adore our problems. It is not good news for us when we hear somebody say, your life is going to get better and there's nothing you can do about it. Oh, really? Or somebody say,
Your problems will die of neglect. What is that? You mean I can't fix them somehow? I want to... That reminds me of something else. There is a remarkable energy and example of principled leadership here. And Jim and I got it from a source that's very interesting. One day when we were early on in sobriety, 3 years maybe, in there, Clancy said one day, you guys want to come down to the mission on Sunday next week? There's going to be an NFL film put on down there. And we said, wow, how's that coming about? He said, well, a guy named Lance, who is a wide receiver for the Rams, and we remembered that he'd been arrested at the airport for possession of pot, which was a big deal in those days. And he had some problem that he'd exposed himself to somebody, too. But the pot was the... That'd be the bigger deal today, the smaller deal, but I don't have any idea. We went down to the mission. You can be sure Byron was there, Jim Shaw was there, I was there. We were at the mission that Sunday night because Lance Rinsel was coming in and the court had ordered him to do some community service, and it finally had been worked out that he was going to once a month go down to mission, put on an NFL film, answer the questions that were asked by the people that were in the mission. And that's what he had to do. And we wanted to see it. We wanted to meet him. We wanted to see the film. We wanted to see the interaction. And we were excited, and we were down there. And then he came in. A little late, but he showed up. And there was a room with 100 guys, sober guys, that were living at the mission, set aside, and the screen was up, and he came in, had all his stuff, and he put on the NFL film, and he answered some questions. Didn't seem very interested in it, but he answered the questions. And after he was folding up his gear to get out of there, we went back into Clancy's office, and we're talking about the evening, and then Lance came back with a chip that Clancy was supposed to sign to indicate to the judge that Lance had been in the mission fulfilling his community service obligation. And Clancy signed it. And the guy said, Lance said, okay, I'll see you next month. And Clancy said, don't come back here. I have to come back here. The judge ordered me to come back here. And she said, I'm not under that order, and I don't want you back here. I don't have to have you back here. We're all sitting there. Here's this wide receiver, and these guys are... And he was stunned. And Clancy said, I don't want you coming back here. He said, why? He said, well, first of all, you showed up late. I mean, we have guys waiting for you to be here, and you're supposed to be here at 7 o'clock, and 7:10 you come sacking in here. I don't know if he said sachet. I just added that in. I might have made that up. And he said, I would have given you a pass on that. But after your film was over, and these men, they're sober men, and they're bright, and they asked you good questions, and you could barely be bothered to give them a response. He said, they may have left their dignity along the side of the road someplace, but we will not take it from them, and we will allow no one to come in and do that. And well, Shaw and I were looking at each other, I can tell you that. And he did a little tap. He said, I got to come back. And they talked a little more. And Clancy said, I'll give it another shot with you. But I want you to do it right. And I want you to be respectful of the men here. Well, we were all down there the next month, I can tell you that. Lance was 5 minutes early, and exactly at 7 that film went on. And after the film, you would have thought that those guys in the room were members of the board of directors of the Rams organization. Being full, complete, respectful answers. And I learned a big lesson. And so did the rest of us. It's principled. And we're about that. We're about that. And when you see it in action, it touches you in ways you don't forget. And so that kind of training, that kind of experience, that kind of, is at play here in the Canyon Conference. It's at play here. There's a wonderful sense of commitment. I'm used to this because I'm from the Pacific group. I'm used to this because of the meeting I go to with John on Thursday night. People show up and do what they said they will do. Oh, every once in a while, one of us will leave our individual honor at the side of the road, tell a lie, or get angry. But as a group of people, there is a great integrity here, and we need it very much. We need to add the integrity back into our lives, and to be able to do it here and have this kind of fun is absolutely priceless. And in situations where your children are welcome, God, look at the example. For the first time in their lives, for some of them, they get to see. I watched young kids grow up in the yard at Clancy, watching their eyes register adults being courteous with one another, respectful of children. Amazing change in the lives of kids. So I had that. I'm 5 years sober, and somebody, not Clancy, somebody said, you ought to go to law school. Who's a lawyer? I had never thought of such a thing. I was selling encyclopedias when I got here and not really doing a very good job of it. It's interesting to have that experience because there is something about this. Look, if you're new, you're living... I was talking to a guy today that was 9 months sober. Is 9 months sober. And glad to be sober. And I observed that had someone a year ago told him that by early June of 2002 you'll have 9 months of sobriety, you could not have believed that. He said, that's right, I could not have. And you cannot believe what will happen to you here. And you can have, Van Noy said it, have your dreams. And I'll tell you a secret. Do not be reasonable. God, don't be reasonable. Set your dream and leave it to be worked out by a power greater than you are and get busy washing porcelain cups. But have your dream. Don't set it aside. I didn't have a dream when I got here, but that guy put a little something in my head. And when I was 9 years sober, and the big question, as you all know, is, do you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to law school? And he said, how old will you be in 4 years if you stay home? And Brian, our speaker tomorrow morning, had the same experience. Marlena had the same experience. And you are already embarked on that. Some of you. I don't know that everybody needs to get an education beyond what they are educated, but I know this. If your dream is consistent with your mission in Alcoholics Anonymous, why not? Why not? Why not have... I remember so clearly the day I stood in the courthouse in Glendale and answered, ready for the defendant. That's a much different thing than being the defendant. I remember the night I'm working late in my office, and some of the dictation of the way you frame pleadings gets to be automatic, but you have to dictate it. And I've got this mic in my hand, and as part of the initial piece of this dictation, which would be meaningless in any other way, you have to say,
My name is Clinton M. Hodges, and I declare as follows. I'm an attorney at law, duly licensed to practice before all the courts in the state of California. I started to cry into the goddamn dictating machine. I said, that can't be me. And I like it. And it's something interesting to do between meetings. And I'm good in court. I let, not because I'm great, but because I let the other guy lie. And they inevitably do that. And the jury inevitably knows that. And I don't lie. Sometimes I wish I could. But I can't. But I can do this. I can love those people in that courtroom. I can love that other attorney. I can love his client. I can love mine. I can love the judge and the jury. Just being aware of who's in the room. You know, there's something so infinitely sweet about being in the room. I get ready to go and I go into trial and I'm there and I got paperwork I couldn't possibly manage. Oh, I know what's there. I know where to find it. But if I'm not in the room, I'm dead. Because in the room is where I can love them. In the room is where I get the shifting energy. In the room is where I know what the judge is up to and what the jury is squirming around or in rapt attention. I know what the other side is doing. And I know how to frame it. And I don't have any brain. God, I learned in law school. And I went at night and I worked during the day and I went to meetings. And I learned in law school. There are something that shocked me. I always knew I had as good a mind as anybody anywhere. In law school, I learned there are better brains than mine just in Los Angeles County. That was a bitter pill, but I had to work harder. And I did. I don't know why I'm getting into all of that, but I would just like you to know this. The one thing I knew I could not have, the one thing I knew I could not have, was a relationship with God and a happy marriage. And there's one relationship. And every other relationship is really reflective of that relationship with God. And in this crazy book called Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a chapter entitled, There is a Solution. And in there, you sort of begin to get curious after a while. There's a solution. I wonder if he's actually written it down in this chapter someplace. And then you come across the solution, and it's the worst possible solution. If what we have seen and felt and heard, it means that each one of us, no matter our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living Creator with whom we may form a personal relationship as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try, and the formation of a relationship with God is absolutely impossible for me, because when I left the Church of the Air, I turned all that off and I began to live a life that took me so far away from that. And I have two other problems with it, and one is that God is way out there someplace and doesn't really want any, I don't want to have anything to do with Him. We heard today, if I should die before I wake, you bet. That'll keep you awake a while. Not that. But I'm a seeker. I'm a seeker. And the search is on. And then I put it aside. And then it's on. And then I put it aside. And then I run amok. Well, a little bit of muck, not a whole amount. You really got something started today. So, I'm sober.
And I've missed the miracle. I'm taking credit for it. If you want to miss the miracles in your life, take credit for the miracle. I did. It leaves you a sense of living your life alone. And I don't have any power. That's another thing that Bob White said that day, that first Canyon conference. And I was not here, but Ben Oye remembered his comment about Our Father. And he said something else. And he was repeating something that somebody else had said, I think, on the tape. He said he wanted so much to be a good kid, and he had no power. He said, if I had made a list of the kind of boy I wanted to be, and my mother had made a list of the kind of son she wanted, those lists would have been very close. And the only problem we have is we don't have any power. I knew it when I was a kid. They tell you you have power. I don't have power. You're a big boy now. I don't have... And it's my secret. It's my secret. I'm not big enough for this life. And nobody must ever know that. I can't tell you that. Instead, what I will do is reach out and try to get some power that I can add to my life so I will be big enough. So I stole money out of my grandma's missionary job to buy candy for the kids. I'd steal candy from giving somebody candy that I've stolen or bought with stolen money makes me big enough. And I'm 16 years old and I discovered the secret. Me and vodka makes me big enough for this life. And I get sober and I'm still looking for power. I need the power. I can't make it. And I got a mind that is, the book says, my mind lacks proportion and can't think straight. That's very harsh language. But I know on the way into town in the morning in Los Angeles how we're doing. That car in the next lane is blinking to come over. You know what you can do. You can lay back a little, let them in. Or you can decide that if that car gets into L.A. 3 seconds before you do, they've won and you've lost. You know, get up, crowd them out of there. I don't have any power. And I hated that. I thought law school, I thought being a lawyer would give me some power. Can you imagine? And it got to be where I was exercising character defects, calling it advocacy, and sending out a bill. Mad at other attorneys. Upset all the time. Screaming and ranting and raving. Because I don't have any power. And that's what Bob said that day. He said, there's no power that is within us except the power that comes from a power greater than we are. And my ego says, don't go there, because you know what? The truth of the matter is, if I tap into that power, I got a big problem. In fact, my life, it's like the middle ground is crazy. If I'm drunk, I'm going to lay around that shed on the linoleum floor. I don't have any power. But if I go down to the front of the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, and get saved, I'm going to China to be a missionary. And I don't have any control over my life. And I can't stand it. So I'm playing in the middle ground, hoping to find some power. And you can do that in AA. I hated it that I didn't have any power. And I hated it that God was way out there and wouldn't help me. And I hated it that I was supposed to be in relationship with this power. Personal. And I don't even know what a relationship is. And the reason that I say that is because it took me a long time to discover the difference between an arrangement and a relationship. And there's a big difference. And there's nothing wrong with an arrangement, if that's what you want. But I wanted relationships, but I was afraid of... And I didn't know that anyway. I thought, this is as good as it gets. An arrangement is a contract.
You bring this, I'll bring that. You don't call me on my stuff, I won't call you on yours. I'll supply the money, you supply the love. And incidentally, I did not, and I never told them this, I did not get all the love I should have gotten as a kid. And I know you love me, and I would like to love you. But you see, there's not enough love. I didn't get what I had coming. And so I can't love you back. I had no idea that the task is simply to learn to give the love you never got. And in that way you get it. That's what Van Oy was talking about last night. Give the love you never got. It's there. But the withhold kicks our fanny. That kind of economy is nuts. And the withhold, everybody gets the withhold, boy. It's like somebody that keeps waiting. You know, the most demanding people in the world are the people who won't tell you what they want. I'm waiting. If you loved me, you would know. Is that face showing enough in the... I'm waiting. Oh. So it's a lonely thing. I don't have God in my life. And the most wonderful thing happened to me. Since I was here last, in about 1990, I totally failed in every department of my life. I lost my practice. This guy came. I was being such a donkey. He didn't want to play with me, and he told me that. And he's the business getter, and I'm the trial guy. Here comes my sister. Can you see it?
Still working.
Okay, it's flickering. So we got some basic stuff going on. I don't know what a relationship is, and I don't know what... You know, one day about that same time, I lost everything. I was living in the right house with the right car. There was an arrangement right there, another one. A lot of income, a lot of spending. I lost it. It just stopped. My image went right out the door, and it scared me terribly. I came from a rough home, and I have one little brother who died a couple of years ago. And he died pushing a cart in Atlanta, Georgia with all his things in it. Not an alcoholic. And I suddenly began to see that that would be my fate. And I moved down the hill and into a little place I hated. I had to reconstruct a law practice. I was going to meetings. I got smacked. It wasn't anything personal. It's just that I'm living an arrogant life. I've forgotten that I'm not big enough for this life, and I'm trying to be big enough for this life. And I got to have that image and all of that. And the long and the short of it was, I came to a place where I had to go back and take those steps again, and if I could have avoided it, I would have done that. If I'd had a choice, I wouldn't have gone back and do it, because I really was kind of avoiding all of that. Don Pritz is a friend of mine in Denver, and he's a very wise guy, and he gave me an interesting analysis of it. He said, well, what did you do when it... I said, you know, before it all hit the fan like that, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was all about how much money, how much impression, all of that stuff. And I knew that it wasn't any good, and so I decided to say the third step prayer on her. He said, you said the third step prayer? And I said, yeah. He said, did you notice at the end of it, it said we thought well before taking this position, making sure we could humbly abandon ourselves to God? I said, I didn't see that.
He said, did you notice in the middle that it says, relieve me of the bondage of self? I said, I saw that. He said, what were you bonded to? Well, my image, my income, whatever. He said, you have to be relieved of that. I said, I guess I did. He said, it took him about 100 days, didn't it? I went, wow, that's an interesting prayer. But I had surrendered again. I surrendered in 1966. I surrendered again in 1990. I surrendered to this simple way of life. And everything changed again. The surrender is the piece where you, and if you're new, you know this, and if you've been around a while, maybe you have forgotten this, but you know what people that surrender, you see it on TV, troops that have surrendered throw their rifles down and they go and... A lot of these people are still here, John. You'll notice that some of you have shifted down 3 feet to be with the person you really want to be. Just get back to you. None of your babies here. Troops that have surrendered throw their rifles down and they go sit at the side of the road and wait for somebody to come along and tell them what to do. Troops that have surrendered throw their rifles, their weapons down, and go sit at the side of the road and wait for somebody to come along and tell them what to do. And I was in that state in 1966 when I came here. All my defenses were gone. I was even able to see that I cannot quit drinking. I threw my defenses at the side of the road, and I went and sat in a meeting of AA and waited to be told what to do. And you told me to set up the chairs. And I said, thank you. I will do that. And I had the straightest rows of chairs in the city. You bet. Because I could take one of those chairs at a meeting. And now we fast forward to 1990. And I went through that same process. But it was very frightening. It was more frightening than anything I'd known in sobriety. Because I have no resources other than my own grab for power, and I had to develop a relationship with God. And that's why I said at the top of this talk that that is within the reach of every one of us, because it happened to me in a hotel room in San Diego as I'm getting ready to go across the street to finish a trial. I knelt at the side of my bed and it happened for me. This book says the great reality is deep within, and I found a place inside me where I can go where God is. Now, this is not necessarily something that is easy to describe, and I won't bother you with it, except that nothing's ever the same again. It's just that it totally changes your view of the world and of AA and the people around you, because you know you're not alone. Father Terry said a remarkable thing. He didn't say anything. He was in Reno, and a cowboy had driven through across the state of Nevada to hear him talk. And it was at about this time that I was standing near Father Terry when this cowboy came up to him and said, I love your talk. I drove across the state to hear you. And he said, how was your drive? He said, it was great. He said, God came with me. He said, wow. Yeah, he got the pickup right around Elko someplace. What did you find out about God? He said, he's very smart. He's real smart. He said, what else did you find out about God? And the cowboy said, he said, he's not pissed off. And I immediately knew that's true. And I didn't know it before that. I lived a life I did not know that. All he can do is love me. And do. And so stuff is coming in, you know. We accept spiritual help, all we have to do is that. It'll come in, it'll come in. And I eventually got on the road to make amends. I got up there in Billings where my mother is buried. I hadn't been in that graveyard for 40 years. I was 54 when I went back. Corbin went there.
I hadn't been there since I was 14, hating my mother as I stood at the grave when they buried her, hating her, knowing she didn't love me. And because of God's grace, I got back there. That takes power to go back there. I was afraid. I thought that my wicked grandmother and my mother would leap out of their graves and get me. I suddenly became that 14-year-old kid again. But Corinne, who was speaking at the same conference, came out of the women's room at noon the day we got up there and said, "Are you going out to the cemetery?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "You're going to need these things with you." And she handed me a shopping bag. And in that shopping bag was a liter of water. And in that shopping bag was some flower seeds and a set of clippers. And some Kleenex and some paper towels. I can't tell you how touched I was at the simple thoughtfulness of this member of Al-Anon. There's a line in the Al-Anon literature someplace, I think it's in the Dilemma of an Alcoholic Marriage. It says, "You will find that daily vigilance is a small price to pay for peace of mind." And I see this wonderful, wonderful force and magical strength and power of the Al-Anon. And I'm so glad you're here. I'm so glad you're here. Because I've seen it time and again, that daily vigilance at work, not in a fix your teeth way, but just an easy awareness of why we're here. And I went out to that grave marker. Finally found a guy in the group, guy out there gave me a ride. And I spent the day out there cleaning that grave up, not knowing what would come of it. And they took me back the next day. I wept all my tears that day. I wept all my tears. I forgave my mother. And you know, you don't have to have a legitimate beef against somebody to forgive them. You just simply have to let it go. You simply have to let it go. But sooner or later, we got to leave that face, that floor of the jungle, with all the stuff in it we thought was so precious. And walk without that impediment. My idea of women changed that day. And my amends to the women in my life included, "I took your dignity. I broke the vows." And it also has to include this. Do you need to tell me how any of that made you feel? And what can I do to make this right? And they will tell you. And you will do it. Why? Because you want to be free. Because you want to be in a state where there's not one person that I have anything going on with anyway. I think I'd rather have it dark than all that. You know? And of course I started taking other guys through this house. One on one. Here's what happened to me. You want to do this? I'll show you. I'll show you. And I watched them pick up this power. I watched them turn their will in their lives with a care. Can you imagine? Grown men kneeling down and saying that third step prayer, just me and another guy in a kitchen, in an office, wherever the hell we were. It's not a big deal, except it's transforming. It's not a big deal, except it's available to a stubborn jerk like me after 23 years of sobriety. I watch these guys go out and make their amends. It's stunning what they do. And you know about Tom. Tom's at our Thursday night meeting. He's there Wednesday night. He's a felon. Tom was a... window washer and a burglar. He knew where to go back at night. And there were 13 homes in South Pasadena that he had burgled. And he hand to drive that old pickup of his up to the door. Get out. Hi. Did you live here 7 years ago when your house was burglarized? Yeah. I did that. And I came here to clean it up with you. And he got a variety of mixed responses, I can be sure to tell you. He did him. He did him because he wants to be free. I know that he can be free. There was one he couldn't get through. He went by once, he couldn't get out of his car. God's not going to be with you. You know the great prayer is, if I go do that, will you go with me? Not a bad prayer. Not a bad prayer. And you know right away, your gut tells you, you're on your own for that. Now the great prayers come out of this. Remember about, and here's Lois Wilson, at her eulogy, wonderful people from around the world, and one of them described three kinds of prayers. We all know them. One is, help me. Always say that. Good prayer. Another one is, give me. We know that prayer. Good prayer. Study prayer. Grant me. And the other one, use me. And it's the sweetest one, because when we've gotten all we get, and when we've been helped all for that can be helped, it isn't about that anymore. It's about use me. It's about my problems will die of neglect. Go sit up and share. My problems will die of neglect. Get that newcomer to a meeting. My problems will die of neglect. Make sure my house is in order. And Tom went out on that last one, that last scary one, and called me and said, I'm done. I said, what happened? Because I could hear in his voice he was freezing. This old couple right there. Old lady came to the door. And she talked to me for a while and had a lot of questions. And then her husband came out and they talked to me. And after a while we're inside and we're sitting in the living room. And why did you take that mirror off the wall? Why did you put... I thought there was a safe behind it. Why did you do that? Why? And they asked him a lot of questions, and at the end he asked the question we must ask. He said, what can I do to set this right? And they said, you don't need to do anything. This is it. He said, why are you saying that to me? And they said, this older couple said, because until right now we always thought our son had done that. And the family healed up and Tom got free and I watched the miracle. Am I going to take these guys through this? Yes, yes, I have no choice. Do I have a gift for doing that? Yes, I have no choice. One drunk at a time. Because my whole idea about women changed, when I knelt at that grave, a lady came into my life. Linda and I have so much fun. The remembrance that I have of my childhood, but before it hit the fan in our house, my mom had so much fun in our house. She would tuck me in. We would say our prayers. We would laugh and tell our secrets. And Linda and I have that going on. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that. A relationship. Workshop. I led a workshop a couple weeks ago. John was there. 50, 60 people there. God was really showing off that weekend, I'll tell you. Everybody. Forgiveness and transformative experiences and the elegance of this power means that you don't have to wait. It isn't like the sweet by and by. And there's something else that's going on, and that is this. Since Linda and I have been together, we have probably had a half a dozen relationships. Because we fit together in one way at first, and then she grew, and I grew, and we didn't complain that the other person was growing. We didn't complain that they were changing. In our binary, it's like, wow, look at that.
And we were talking about this, and then there was some sharing, and Linda raised her hand, and I heard her say this. I heard her say, sometimes, because somebody was afraid to say something, and she said, sometimes I'm afraid to hear things. Sometimes I get scared when Clint talks to me. And immediately a red light went off for me, and I thought, oh my God. Oh, I'm back to that. Oh, I thought that was gone. And she continued as I held my breath, and she said, you know what I'm afraid? Because I don't think I really want to get how much she loves. And I thought, we're in a good relationship. We're off on something else. I don't know where it'll go. I'm into a new relationship with God because of this weekend and because of you. And I'm into a new relationship with AA, and it could be new every day you want it to be. I started by telling you the last 7 years have been the sweetest of all. I've seen miracles. I've been part of miracles. I've watched miracles. And I have become somebody that is effective. And I didn't even want to go there. You want me in China? What the hell's the difference? I'll go to China. You seem to want me to stay in Los Angeles and pay my bills. I've been so blessed. So blessed to be here. Thank you.